All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gym Fear 138 podcast. Now, I know that you guys were expecting to have Jesse Abraham Lucas on this week. I had mentioned that on Twitter. I had planned that podcast like some 2 weeks ago or so. And we had the conversation. We sat down and I recorded the whole thing via OBS. And I went to edit it. And it turns out that I had neglected... I had been using this old version of OBS from like 2 or 3 years ago. And it had just never updated. And I thought that was a little bit weird, but I didn't think anything of it because it did what I needed it to do. Then Dan Wolfgang, who I don't blame this on, by the way, he got me to upgrade to the new OBS so that if I ever wanted to, I could do live streams. Well, I did. And for some reason, whenever I start recording with OBS and I'm in a Discord call, OBS mutes the Discord down to like 3/4 of its original volume, right? So it did that during the conversation with Jesse, and I didn't notice it because he was still coming through fine on my end. I could hear him just perfectly well. We had a great conversation. However, the audio recording as it came out the other end, I am way too loud. And Jesse sounds like he's coming through on a tin can and a string from about half a mile away. And I tried everything I could do on my end to boost the audio, and when I boosted his audio, all you could hear were like my mouth clicks. You could hear him talking, but it was muted, it was kind of garbled. And like I say, you could hear everything that I was doing over his voice. So if I set my beer can down, you would hear that, and it would cut out his voice. You know, if I swallowed or if I exhaled some cigarette smoke or something like that, it would cut off his voice. So I talked to Christopher Warren about it, and I sent him a sample of the audio, and not even he can save it. And when the guy who does the audio engineering for Dimension Bucket Media cannot save your audio file, it is unfucking usable. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to scrap the conversation that Jesse and I had. And hopefully I'll be able to get him on again and we'll be able to have another conversation that will hopefully be just as productive. But for right now, I'm going to have to record this emergency podcast so that I can get something out this week. Because I'm damned and determined to have a podcast out for the weekend of the 20th, the 19th. Even if it's late, it's going to come out. So I figured I would just pick a couple. This is all spur of the moment. I just found all of this out, so we're going to do some spur of the moment podcast, some just off the top of my head shit. Hopefully I'll get a good hour or two out of it, but we'll see how it goes. So, just in update news, before I get into anything, because I do have a couple of things that I came up with that I can talk about. But just in kind of update news, I realized that like a jackass, I had not actually compiled my Steemit stories into any one place so that they could be easily accessible to anybody who wanted to read them. So now, if you go to my website and you look up at the top, there's that bar up there that's got like podcasts and editorials and stuff like that. Over on the far right, there's a tab that says original fiction. You just click that, it'll take you to a different page on the blog. And it's got all of my stories listed in order from oldest to most recent. So if you were looking to go and read any of my Steemit stories, but you just didn't want to try trolling through my Steemit profile, or you didn't want to have to go look up the website and then look up my profile and then find all of that shit, now it's got links directly to all of the parts of the stories in order. I checked all of the links, and they all open in new windows, so it's all fine. But yeah, if you're looking to get a hold of any of my writing, you can just go over there. The Glimmervale audiobook has been pushed back because Amazon is butts. Basically, they sent Michael Kingswood, the author, a notice saying that there wasn't enough basically dead air in between the segments. So at the beginning and end of each audio file, there wasn't enough dead air. So now I have to go in and fix all of that and give them a good 2 to 3 seconds at the beginning and at the end of each chapter. So that's going to be a pain in the ass to fix, but I'm going to get that fixed and sent over to him, so hopefully the Glimmervale audiobook will actually be out within the next week or two. I think that's it. Oh, I also set up a tip jar on Ko-fi, or Ko-fi, however you pronounce it. It's basically just a PayPal tip jar that kind of circumvents PayPal's terms and conditions, I guess. Basically, PayPal has this thing about tip jars where if people aren't you know, if you're not working as a charity or as a charitable organization, having up a donations jar is kind of frowned upon, and they might pull it at any time. But Ko-fi kind of gets around that. So if you just want to drop a couple of shekels in the hat, buy me a coffee, I could frankly use the fucking caffeine. Then you can go over there and check out my Ko-fi profile. I also have an author's page on Amazon now. Right now it's very rudimentary. It's only got Darkest of Dreams, but I've got a couple of other things that I'm going to be putting up there later. And, that book of, Steam It fiction is going to be coming out pretty soon. Within, like, the next, I don't know, month or two. And Christopher Ward and I have been talking, and we're thinking about just releasing some short fiction via Amazon so that we can get it on Kindle Unlimited, just to kind of test that out. Because I know that Vox Day has had certain levels of success with Kindle Unlimited putting Castalia House books up there, so we're going to try that out and see how it goes. I will let you guys know when things go live. But for right now, I do have an Amazon authors page, so you can go over there and follow me and... it will inform you whenever I release something new on Amazon. And the Steam It fiction is free to read. So, have fun with that. They're good stories, I promise. So how about that Thundercats reboot? This is just something that I've seen going around like Twitter and Tumblr for the past few days. It looks horrible. It looks fucking horrible. Now, I should mention at the outset of talking about this that I'm not a fan of Thundercats, right? I never watched the old show. I was more into, like, G.I. Joe and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Transformers, back from that era of cartoons. I also watched Dino Riders, which points to anybody who remembers that fucking show at all. I think I'm one of, like, five people who actually fucking watched it. But I never watched Thundercats. You know, I kind of regret that now, and I'm taking steps to correct that. I'm actually going to go and watch the old cartoon. I haven't had the chance to do it yet, but this kerfuffle with Thundercats Roar has just kind of ignited my interest in the series, because I always kind of knew, oh, it's like Lion-O and Chitara and Panthro and, you know, the Thundercats Assemble. I don't fucking know. I never watched the show. But I always did like the art style. The art style was always very cool. The characters looked distinct, and it looked like a pretty neat show so far as, like, 80s toy commercial cartoons goes. And now that I actually have done a little bit of digging into, like, what the Thundercats actually was, you know, I'm really interested in going and watching this show now, because it's apparently, like, science fantasy. It's just a good old-school fucking pulp romp set to 80s toy commercial cartoons. You know, because they're not like, it's not like, it's basically a Sword and Planet story. It's not like fantasy where they're Khajiit or something like that, like you'd see in the Elder Scrolls. They're actually aliens. I didn't know that for the longest fucking time. Like, literally my entire, 30 years. I didn't know that the Thundercats were actually aliens who were like cat people, I guess. God, the furries are going to have a field day with this. They actually already are. By the way, it's been pretty funny watching people just react to this and the whole, like people aren't phrasing it this way. I've been phrasing it this way, but the general sense from the fan base, from people who aren't shills and, you know, who actually do like the Thundercats and watch the old show and the reboot that happened around 2011 with the kind of almost anime, more like original Teen Titans series inspired art, kind of realistic art. Looked more like something out of the DC cartoon universe rather than the original Thundercats or, you know, this abomination that has recently been announced. But one thing that I do know about the Thundercats is that it played it straight. You know, I've seen clips here and there, but from what I gathered, it was exactly like the old Transformers cartoon. It was exactly like the old, G.I. Joe cartoon. It was played straight. It was earnest. But this new thing, and it turns out that Cal Leo guy or whatever it is, the guy, the smug asshole with the fucking CalArts avatar. I can't remember his fucking name. It turns out that guy isn't actually working on the show. He's just a dick. The guy who was talking about how what was it? The animation industry thrives on destroying people's childhood and shit like that. And, you know, it's just, he's just a dick. He doesn't actually work on the show. I can understand why people think that he works on the show, because he's been avidly defending it and acting, frankly, like a lot of Marvel creators, where people will say that they don't like the art style that Marvel comic is going in. Like, for example, people who say that they enjoyed the old Squirrel Girl comic, but they don't like the art direction of the new one, just get relentlessly shit on by the creators. So the people who are, should be trying to sell this product to these people, who are ostensibly fans of this franchise, are shitting on these people who otherwise would probably be interested in the product that they're trying to push. So they're actively pushing their audience away. And given that we see a lot of that behavior from the SJW creators and shit, it's understandable that people would mistake this guy for someone who actually works on the show, given that he claims to be in the animation industry, and he's avidly defending this and calling the people who are complaining about it, rightfully complaining about it, I should add, you know, man babies and children and shit like that, and he's been one of the most vociferous defenders on Twitter. So it's understandable that people would get that twisted. But he doesn't work on the show. He's just an asshole. But as I was saying, the old Thundercats cartoon played shit straight. That was a hero story. You know what I mean? There would be the villain of the week, and shit would happen. They would defeat the villain, and go back to the... None of these episodes, very rarely, in my experience, did cartoons from the 80s have arcs over multiple episodes. There might be a few, like I remember Transformers did like the Dinobots arc, where they had the introduction of the Dinobots and the creation of the Constructicons and shit like that. But most of the time, it was, oh, what are the Decepticons doing this week that we have to stop? And then, you know, within like 24 minutes or so, they would stop them. And that's kind of how I think that the Thundercats went. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, because like I say, I didn't watch the old show, but That's how most of those old shows went. Every once in a while, they would do a big narrative arc that would actually advance the overall story. But most of the time, it was just kind of your evil plot of the week thing. But the one thing that you notice about all of those shows is, like I said, they played it earnest. They were very forthright about their intentions. They weren't trying to do the wink and nod. They weren't trying to be genre savvy or self-aware or anything like that. It was a good old-fashioned hero story told like a good old-fashioned hero story. Now, with this new shit, you get stuff like Adventure Time. Now, I don't watch Adventure Time either. You know, I'm not a fan of that style of art. It just kind of gets to me. Like, what was that show on YouTube that's done by the people who do Adventure Time? I cannot fucking remember. It's like a science fantasy show, and it's meant to be silly and goofy and have some adult jokes, but most of the time it's just kind of for kids. It was funny, but the art style kind of put me off. You know, the cartoon with the ladybug cat. I cannot fucking remember what the name of the show is. But this new Thundercats Roar thing, I don't understand why. Whenever somebody decides to reboot something like the Thundercats, they decide to take a big old steaming dump on the original fan base. And it's not just with the art style, it's with the entire approach to the thing. So nothing can be played straight anymore. For example, with like the stories that I write stories that are much more in the vein of the old pulps, or at least I try to. You know, they're meant to be heroic action-adventure stories where it's 100% serious. Yes, there are magic and evil creatures and shit like that, and there's a lot of genre tropes and all of that kind of stuff that I put into play because I like that kind of stuff. But I'm not trying to look at the audience and go, hey, you know, isn't this silly? Isn't this a little bit, you know, funny? Isn't it weird and wacky that we're engaging in this kind of stuff just for fun? And the fun is really in making fun of it, not in actually presenting this stuff as a hero tale or anything like that. These people seem to take active pleasure in just destroying this kind of stuff, in playing it off for laughs. Like, oh, he's not really a hero. He's, you know, a sociopath, but he acts like a hero, so, you know, he qualifies, or whatever, you know, like you see this in modern fantasy fiction and all kinds of other places. Mostly it's been confined to like comic books and animation, because fantasy fiction and science fiction are more concerned nowadays with being taken quote-unquote seriously, which is something that I've never understood. But with this this Thundercats Go thing, it's just like the art style is fuck ugly. It is fuck ugly. It is like leprous warts on a troll's cancerous cock ugly. And I'm just done with this fucking Cal art style, you know. And I know that it's, you know, fashionable to shit on Cal arts. It's like it's a meme at this point. But really, like this Steven Universe, Gravity Falls, Adventure Time, you know, Star versus the Forces of Evil art style. I've never watched any of these shows because the art style is... Well, okay, that's not entirely true. I watched one episode of Gravity Falls, and it was pretty entertaining. You know, it was actually pretty funny. But just the art style puts me off. And Gumball is another example, The Amazing World of Gumball. Just the art style of these shows. Now, Gumball does something interesting because the cartoon characters all have that same, you know, B-shaped head. Like the lowercase letter B shaped head. But they also mix in like actual pictures. Like they would go and photograph a storefront or something like that. And then they would, you know, have the storefront be a static image as the background. And then they would animate the characters, you know, the cartoons on the store. So they're kind of doing this Mary Poppins thing. So Gumball kind of, it doesn't necessarily get a pass on the art style, but at least they did something mildly original with having, like, photorealistic backgrounds. But the rest of the art style is just fucking hideous. Like, not even the fact that Jake the dog in Adventure Time is voiced by Bender from Futurama can get me to watch Adventure Time. You know, I'm just not interested in putting that shit into my eyeballs. And it's the same thing with Thundercats. Like, my first exposure to the whole Thundercats Go thing, because it's Teen Titans Go is another example of this. But yeah, this is basically, you know, Steven Universe Thundercats. My first exposure to this was promotional art. Like, I didn't watch the trailer, I didn't watch the announcement trailer until, like, I don't know, like 2 or 3 days into this. And when I did, I was really disappointed. Because, like I say, the old Thundercats cartoon, I'd never watched it, but I've seen promotional material and I've seen clips here and there and shit like that. You know, I'm culturally aware of Thundercats. I'm aware of what the show is and what they did with it, because I didn't exist at the time when all of these shows were airing, but my local video store had like the entire backlog for all of this shit. Like, back before Blockbuster came into town, we would go into the local video store and we would rent, you know, a couple of cartoons and a couple of NES games or a Super NES game or something like that, and we would watch all of this shit. So I got to watch the old, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon, the real Ghostbusters, which was the cartoon from the 80s, like I say, Transformers, G.I. Joe, all of that shit. So I know the general formula that these cartoons took, and just the amount of subversion. This is another thing that I cannot fucking stand anymore, and I blame the Superversives for this. It is y'all's fault that I cannot enjoy subversive media anymore. Because there's nothing left to subvert. All of the, like, okay, let me explain why subversion is bad. Nowadays. Why it's bad now. Because back when the subversive movement crept into literature and comic books and music and, you know, just all of these different facets of culture, there were actually cultural standards and moral standards for art and literature and music and all of this other stuff. So when you come along and you subvert this stuff, it's shocking. It's like when Alice Cooper first came on the scene in music. Nobody had ever seen anything like him. You know, this guy comes out and he's got these elaborate stage shows and he's like faux decapitating people and shit like that. He was the original shock rock artist. So with the subversive movement, it was actually something new. Like Watchmen is actually a good example, because back when Watchmen came out, most comics back in that day were actually heroic and shit. Like, let me actually look up when Watchmen came around. I've got the omnibus over there, but I don't feel like actually going and grabbing it. It would be easier to just go to DuckDuckGo at this point. Here we go. 86 and 87. Okay. Yeah, so I've got... I've recently been reading the Birth of Venom omnibus that I have, because Venom is my favorite Spider-Man character. I like him better than Spider-Man. Venom was just the absolute coolest shit when I was a kid. So I picked up the Birth of Venom omnibus a while back, used, of course, and I just started reading it. And these comics are from like 1984. So they're very concerned with Spider-Man being a hero and doing everything right. And, you know, they played it straight back then. And then Alan Moore comes along with Watchmen, and he makes this thing where, you know, the heroes don't really get to be heroes and they don't really have a proper moral compass like a character like Spider-Man has. So you get like Doc Manhattan, who is just a god at this point, and he cannot think on the level of humans. So his moral compass is completely out to lunch. He doesn't have one anymore, at least as we understand a moral compass. Or you get characters like Ozymandias, who actually turns out to be the villain of Watchmen, because he's the one who's going to try to unite the world by giving them a greater enemy to face. And he actually winds up doing it at the end of the book. So it's kind of like, is he the hero? Is he the villain? And then you get a character like Rorschach, who is the fan favorite, because he has a definitive moral compass. He is a black and white good guy. Even if he is the most violent psychopath you've ever fucking met, he's like a insane combination of the Punisher and the Shadow without all of the money. He's the one with a moral compass. He's the one that the fans latched onto and identified with because he definitively took down the bad guys, which is completely opposite to Moore's intentions with this. He was intending to break down the superhero dynamic and the superhero stereotype and do different things with it and subvert it. So when Watchmen came out, it was new and fresh and kind of amazing, you know, what Moore had done with Watchmen. So back when the superversive movement kind of took hold of all of these different industries, there was actual shit to subvert, you know, and then subversion got really popular. It just became the thing to do. You were just like all of these people who were clutching their pearls over how, you know, morally ambiguous Watchmen was or something like that, or how subversive certain musical genres were like punk rock. They were actually having fun subverting these things, and they were making a point. That point being, you know, this shit isn't as sacred as you think it is. It's not that necessary that we stick to these archetypes or that we stick to these certain conventions. We can do other stuff, which is all well and good. But when this goes on for 40 years or so, since about the late 60s, when this goes on for 40 to 50 to 60 years, it starts to get fucking tired. Eventually, you have subverted so much that you hit bedrock, and there's nothing else left to subvert. So that's why when the Marvel movies came out, and there's zero moral ambiguity here, there's, you know, Iron Man is the good guy. You know, what's his fuck from the first movie is the bad guy. You know, when Thor comes out and Loki is acting like a douche, Loki is the bad guy. Thor is the good guy. There are white hats and there are black hats, and people latched onto that because it was an earnest presentation of these characters. You know, when Captain America comes into the picture, he's the good guy. He's obviously the fucking good guy. And they like to throw in a little bit of moral ambiguity with, like, the Winter Soldier and Bucky and his redemption arc and everything. But for the most part, the Marvel movies are played as white hats and black hats. They're very earnest. They're very set in their moral grounding. So when you get something that is actively subversive, like, you know, this Thundercats roar thing, it tends to piss people off because we've been steeped in a culture of subversiveness for so fucking long that there's actually nothing left to subvert anymore. You know, the word subversion, there's actually a really good essay on this at bondwine.com, and I will try to find it and put it down in the description so that you guys can read it. But he makes a great point in this essay about how subversion is about digging under the towers of old and making them crumble and, you know, doing new things and digging down under the foundations to destroy. But that's the fundamental point of subversion, is to destroy what came before and do new things with it. However, at its base, subversive material is just digging. It's not actually building anything. It's just destroying what came before. It's entirely reactionary. And like with most reactionary movements, there's nothing that's actually going to be built by it. It's one of those things where, you know, they don't actually have a plan beyond biting their thumb at what has gone on before, you know, what has become established as a norm. There's no plans to actually build anything new. That all they can do is take the old and make it, you know, bad, make fun of it. Now, with superversive literature specifically, which is what this is kind of translated into, but it's starting to gain ground in wider culture, although it's not known as superversive material, so far as your average person is concerned. With superversive material, it's saying, okay, we are at bedrock. There is nothing left to subvert. What is actually subversive now is building new shit. And that's why I like the superversive movement. I've mentioned this before in the podcast, but that's why I like the superversive movement, because they're actually concentrated on building things. So if you go read the fiction of, say, John C. Wright, his fiction is actually superversive. It's actually building. He is steeped in these old pulp stories and these old novels from back in the heyday of actual science fiction and fantasy literature. So he knows what he's doing, and he's able to take those themes and translate them for a modern audience while still keeping the writing at, you know, his usual godly level. We can't all be him, unfortunately. But with the superversive thing, as I said, it's mostly about building, which is what part of what I'm trying to do. Usually the superversives, if you ask them, it will be tied to some sort of religiosity. There can be Buddhist superversive literature. There can be Christian superversive literature. It just needs to be building on something and have a connection to a higher power, is basically their point. Now, I don't think that you necessarily need the higher power to do this. I think that you just need to present what you are doing in earnest and stop with the wink and nod bullshit. Just stop trying to subvert and start trying to build. You can build out of anything. You can take all kinds of different building blocks. For example, science fantasy, the combination of science fiction and fantasy fiction that used to be extremely prevalent back in the pulp era, isn't really used much anymore. And if it is, it's usually, as I said, in the subversive manner. They're trying to show how silly all of this stuff is. But I'm kind of taking that science fantasy thing and, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be based in a religious worldview, I guess, because I don't have one. But I can take the building blocks of science fantasy and build something new out of them. You know, I can do my own thing with this particular Lego set and actually make something fun that's presented earnestly that people will actually enjoy, because I'm not asking them to, you know, decipher pretentious hidden meanings in my writing. I'm not asking them to apply this to their political philosophy. I'm not asking them to reshape the way that they see the world based on my writing. I'm just saying, here's a fun story that I wrote. I hope that you enjoy it. And then they'll either enjoy it or they won't. But the big difference between me and a subversive writer, like, say, John Scalzi, is I'm presenting my shit honestly. I'm not trying to subvert anything. I'm trying to build. I'm technically a superversive, in the loosest sense of the term. If you ask the superversives, you might get a different answer here. Although I am being published in their Earth anthology that's coming up here soon, hopefully. So maybe I'm less wrong about this than I thought I was. But that aside, what this Thundercats Roar thing is doing is it's taking the old show and turning it into a joke. And, you know, the guy has said that for every step we're taking towards comedy, we're taking two steps towards action and adventure. Well, you may think that you are. And, you know, maybe the guy legitimately does think that. Maybe he's not putting up a front. Maybe he's not shilling. Maybe he's not presenting a dishonest opinion, trolling people in effect. Maybe he believes that. But when you do this whole extreme self-awareness, it really gets under people's skin, especially when what they came to the old show for was that earnest heroism and action and adventure. Not the wink and nod, not the playful, oh, look how silly this all is. You know, it's cat aliens on another planet, and wow, isn't this wacky? Look at how fuck ugly we can make our art. No, people didn't come to it for that. They came to it for, oh, look, this is cat aliens on another planet, and they have this villain who's always trying to fuck with them. And they have swords and all kinds of weapons, and they go out there and they kick ass every Saturday morning. That's what people came to that original show for. And I had just watched Just Some Guy, who is a comic reviewer on YouTube. He also comments on various cultural things like this. But he had done a video about Thundercats Roar. I keep wanting to call it Thundercats Go because it reminds me of the Teen Titans Go reboot, which is exactly the same problem. The original Teen Titans cartoon, I was in love with. I might have been a little bit old for it at the time, but that's stupid. I really don't get that, oh, you're too old for this bullshit. Y'all are being pretentious. Y'all need to calm the fuck down. Stop taking yourself so damn seriously. But with Teen Titans, it was an earnest hero story. You know, yeah, there were moments of comedy in it, and it had its funny moments, and some of them were really, really fucking funny. You know, the stuff with Beast Boy was actually really, really entertaining. He was kind of the comic relief character of that show. But they would also do jokes with Cyborg, and even Raven, and of course Starfire, and Robin. But at the end of the day, that show was a superhero drama show, and it got heavy by the time it was canceled. I mean, really heavy. Like, we find out that Raven's father was possibly sexually abusive towards her near the end of that show. It was like what they did with Digimon Tamers, which is the third run of Digimon, where, like, at the end of the season, at the end of the show, we're finding out that, like, one of the characters' parents is dying, and they're having to deal with the death of their parents while the world is being destroyed, and it just gets really fucking heavy. So, you've got this really nice show that's presented earnestly with jokes and humor and shit like that, but at the end of the day, it's a superhero drama. And then they reboot it, and it's just 100% meme fodder. That's all it's there for. It's doing the wink and nod. It's presenting this subversively. It's trying to subvert the charm of the original show and turn it into a joke and a big slap in the face to fans, which is why nobody who actually likes the old Teen Titans cartoon actually enjoys Teen Titans Go. They even did an entire... Here's the best example of this. There's a villain that came up in Teen Titans and Teen Titans Go. And I don't remember what his name was, but he had the power over television. And he could just, like, do things with TVs that nobody else could do. It was almost like magic. And in this episode of Teen Titans Go, which I saw clips from on Tumblr, I believe, he actually sits the Teen Titans Go Titans down and gets them to watch the entirety of the old show. They do this whole meta fourth wall thing where they show the characters what their show used to be. And then they find out that that show got canceled before it could have a proper ending. And the characters were actually pissed about it. How could they cancel that show? It was so good. Why would they cancel it? And then they made a big joke about how, you know, now this new show is so much better and shit like that. Basically, they're spitting on the fans of the old show. And that's the problem that people have. So when people see a remake like Teen Titans Go or Thundercats Roar, we know instinctively that you're not doing this to appeal to the old fans who, as Just Some Guy said in his video, which I'll link in the description, it's very informative. He even shows some good old concept art that was really fucking cool from the old show and the reboot in 2011. But the problem with this is that, you know, the old fans, like, if I was going to watch, like, let's say I had kids and they made a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles show. And I was like, oh, I used to watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when I was a kid. So, you know, they're coming out with this new show, and I think my kids will like it. So I'll sit my kids down, and we'll watch the old show. And then we'll watch the new show together, and it can be like this cool family bonding experience, you know? Especially if the new show looks like it's actually going to faithfully represent TMNT. But if it looks like it's just going to be a huge piss take on TMNT, then why would I watch it, and why would I get my kids to watch it? Why would I actively try to bring the next generation of possible fans in on this thing? You know, if you're actively shitting on everything that I love, don't expect me to eat it with a smile and then ask you for more. You know, why should I get excited about that? Why should I try to get other people to watch it? Why should I watch it myself? You know, which is why I'm going to go and watch the old Thundercats cartoon, and I'm going to watch the reboot of the Thundercats cartoon from 2011, and I'm just going to forget that Thundercats Roar exists, because you can tell with the art style that it's just lazy. It is lazy. That is the point of this. Like, you look at the difference between Lion-O in the old school Thundercats cartoon and Lion-O in the 2011 reboot, and Lion-O in Thundercats Roar, and the only conclusion that you can come to is that that artist is lazy. And apparently, according to just some guy who has more knowledge on this than I do, this has to do with digital art. Which, digital art isn't a bad thing. I'm not going to go into a screed on how it's not real art. No, it is. It is. It's just a different method. But when you essentially draw the character one time and then you're using animation software to stretch the lines out and make these character models do all kinds of different things, you get to be extraordinarily lazy with how this art is presented. And back in the day, of course they would have animation errors, but for the most part, all of that shit was hand-drawn, and they had to do all of it themselves. They didn't have computers that could, you know, animate the show for them, basically. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I've seen shows with flash puppets that do extraordinarily well. Like, you know, you might shit on me for liking the My Little Pony Friendship is Magic cartoon, but as the seasons went on, the animation got really good, particularly after the first movie came out. They really started to understand the software that they were using, and they made some very cool cinematics in that cartoon with flash puppets, essentially. So I'm not doing a screed against flash puppets here. It's just this art style is lazy. It is very lazy, and from what I hear, it is tied into using computers to stretch the lines out and pose the characters and basically do the animation for you, so that you don't have to worry about it, and you can basically cut costs on the show. But, you know, fans of the old show, and there are a lot of them that are very angry about this, look at this, and they see this as you spitting on the legacy of the Thundercats. Which, it's a cartoon, okay? It's, you know, it is what it is. It's a cultural touchstone for a lot of people, but at the end of the day, it's a fucking cartoon. But at the same time, it's a cartoon that has touched a lot of people's lives, and a lot of people remember it fondly. You know, I might actually become a fucking convert after I watch it, because I really like those old school 80s toy commercial cartoons. I really fucking enjoyed them. I enjoyed them as a kid, and I still enjoy them as an adult. I can still go and watch Transformers and G.I. Joe and Dino Riders and stuff like that, and still enjoy it. Even though I'll admit that it's not nearly as good as I thought it was when I was a kid, but it's still good. You know, it's just not as good as I remember it being when I was fucking 9 years old or whatever. But these people see you spitting on the legacy of something that they like. And that's not going to endear them to your project. Just saying. And once again, this ties into the whole subversion thing. They're not trying to play this straight. They're trying to subvert the Thundercats. Because inherently, I think the issue is that the people behind this are not creative people. I think that's the issue with most subversive people. Even me, back when I was still trapped in the subversive mindset, most of my fiction from back then is bogged down in trying to subvert tropes. It's depressing. I think I did some cool stuff, but at the end of the day, it's really depressing bullshit. You know, I was trying to subvert shit that had been subverted fucking 30 years before I was born, or like 20 years before I was born. You know, Philip K. Dick had already told half of the stories that I was trying to tell, just in a different way with my own characters and shit. It's not like I was writing fan fiction, but at the same time, you know, my shit was by no means quote-unquote original. Now, I feel like I'm doing a much better job since I've given up trying to be original, and I've given up trying to be subversive. I'm just trying to play it straight. We're doing straight sci-fi, fantasy, action, and adventure. But people can sense when you're trying to shit on the thing that they love, especially when they call you on it and you get really, really defensive. I can understand if you're being called something you're not, getting upset. But when you are actively subverting something, and you're actively trying to destroy a thing that people like, and people call you on it, and you throw a fucking shit fit tantrum, there's probably some merit to the accusations that people are leveling at you. You know, they're probably right that you're trying to destroy this thing that they love. Especially when a whole bunch of shills leap out of the fucking woodwork to defend this thing. And you start to notice that when you go and dig in all of these people's Twitter profiles, which I don't have the time to do personally, but I have seen screen caps and, you know, various people showing various threads and things like that. you start to realize that all of these people are basically ideologically aligned together. They basically are progressive leftist liberals. Usually social justice warriors, some form of Marxist, something like that. Very interested in subverting tropes and doing subversive artwork and tearing down what came before so that people don't think it's as great as they remember it being. This is like when you see people talking about H.P. Lovecraft's fiction and how horrible and sexist and misogynistic and racist he was, and how they're going to quote-unquote reclaim something that they have never owned and basically subvert the Lovecraft Cthulhu mythos into a more social justice, politically correct version of itself. Basically, they're going to skin it and wear the skin like in Silence of the Lambs. They're going to like tuck their dick in between their legs, and they're going to dance around the goodbye horses wearing the skin of the thing that you loved. And, you know, if they were doing this on their own blogs or their own little YouTube channel or whatever like that, I wouldn't have a fucking problem with it, okay? I really wouldn't care. If this was like a bunch of Wattpad people who were trying to reclaim H.P. Lovecraft, quote-unquote, I wouldn't have a fucking problem with it. Because, you know, it's their Wattpad, they can do whatever the fuck they want. It's their YouTube channel, it's their cartoon, they can do whatever they want with it. But when you start doing this officially, when you start getting, like, the Science Fiction Writers of America in on this, when you start getting, like, the Hugos in on this, when you start taking Lovecraft's bust out of awards ceremonies and actively trying to destroy his legacy, they're also trying to do the same thing with Tolkien right now. Imagine the crack that you would have to smoke to think that Tolkien was a racist. Just imagine that. But people have seen this a lot. We have seen this kind of phenomenon happen a whole bunch. And we're tired of it. We're very, very much tired of it. We are really fucking sick of you people coming along and telling us that your thing is so much better when you have a zero creativity in your body. There is not a creative drop in your blood. There's not a creative bone in your body. You know, these people look at people who actually created something, like Robert E. Howard or H.P. Lovecraft, or people like them, Edgar Rice Burroughs. They look at the people like the guys who created the original Thundercats. And they say, I can't do something like that. I can't do something that's that nice that will capture people's attention like that. But I can take that thing and make it suck. You know, I can reimagine it in my own little way. And then people will like it because they like the old thing. And after all, I'm so much better than the guys who originally created it because I'm not racist and I'm not sexist and I'm not, you know, transphobic or what the fuck ever. And what they do is I wind up destroying that thing. And people are really tired of seeing things that we like destroyed. It's like what happened with Star Wars. You know, the original Star Wars trilogy was very spiritual. Very spiritual. And it had this undercurrent of mysticism running through it. And it was, moreover, played straight. And they didn't try to explain the mysticism, it just was. It was a fact of this universe. And the heroism of people like Han Solo and the evil of people like Darth Vader and Boba Fett, these were character archetypes that people resonated with. You know, the upcoming hero who becomes the Jedi Knight, who falls to the dark side in Luke Skywalker, and then redeems himself and saves his father in spirit, if not in body, at the end of the series. It's so nice. People loved it. And then the prequel movies came out, and they still played things straight. I've watched the prequel movies, you know, recently. I enjoy the prequel movies, you know, excoriate me for my bad taste later. I actually like the prequel movies, despite the fact that they tried to bring a certain level of scientific realism into Star Wars, which is missing the point by leagues and leagues and leagues. But then you get the sequel trilogy that's coming out now, like, what was it? The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. And they are pale imitations of the original trilogy. They basically told A New Hope twice and did it badly. Like, okay, I have nothing against the character of Finn, the black guy. I can't fucking remember the name. John Boyega, that's his name. The actor John Boyega's character, Finn. I have nothing against the guy. He's probably a perfectly fine actor. I've never watched him in anything. But there was a moment in The Last Jedi where Finn was going to destroy the Doomsday device that was going to kill them all. and he was going to make this, he was making this heroic charge across these salt plains. And he was going to drive his fighter into the Doomsday device and sacrifice himself and save everybody. And then Rose Tycho just slams him out of the way and completely fucking ruins the moment. It's like, you could not miss the point any harder. So they've taken, like, the mysticism out with the prequel trilogy. There's no more mysticism. It's all explained by science. We have midichlorians and shit like that. And then in the sequel trilogy, they're taking out all of the heroism and all of the things that made the characters great. And what's more, they're actively shitting on and killing these characters that everybody loves and that nobody wants to see die. Not in that way, at least. They're actively shitting on and killing these characters off, and it's pissing off the fan base of the original movies. It's pissing off the actual Star Wars fans, which is why you only see people defending these films, the sequel trilogy, who are complete leftists. They're ideologically invested in what the new Star Wars movies are trying to push. And that's the problem with not only the art style, but the entire approach of Thundercats Roar, is that people can smell this shit from a mile away now. You know, most people didn't even have to look at the trailer. We could look at the art and tell that this was going to be a subversive shit show that was going to take the original Thundercats concept and mangle it beyond fucking recognition for a social justice outcome. Even if that outcome is just destroying good things that people enjoy, because God fucking forbid you ever enjoy anything, just based purely on its own merits. God forbid anybody have fun. You know what I mean? No, everything has to be political. Everything is sexist, everything is racist, everything is problematic, and we have to point it all out. That's their mantra. And for a long time, they got away with this. You know, people kind of let them get away with their shit, and it wasn't really that big of a deal, you know? It was like, okay, a thing here, a thing there, whatever. You know, nobody really minds. But then, recently, in the past 10 years or so, they started ramping up production of this kind of stuff, and it's just everywhere at this point, and people are sick of it. We just don't want it anymore. People are hungering for tales like John Carter of Mars, or Tarzan, or Conan, or Kull, or Solomon Kane, or even just H.P. Lovecraft's old horror stories that are just played completely straight. You know, like, for example, I recently picked up Peaceable Kingdom by Jack Ketchum. Now, Jack Ketchum is probably one of the best horror writers I've ever encountered in my entire life. He's better than Stephen King, at least in my experience. Now, Stephen King really, his novels aren't all that great, but he really shines in his short fiction. Jack Ketchum's short fiction is way better than Stephen King's. Frankly, Jack Ketchum deserves to be in the place that Stephen King is at right now. But my personal, you know, hate boner for Stephen King aside, gonna have to, like, shove that off, like, put it under a fucking blanket and lay some cinder blocks on top of it. That thing is so big. But, yeah, my personal hate boner for Stephen King aside, Jack Ketchum's stories in Peaceable Kingdom are played straight. There's no subversive going on here. He's not trying to subvert tropes and shit like that. Like, there's one story, I wish I could remember the name of it, but I've been reading so much lately that I'm just not, I can't remember the name of the story. But it's basically about this guy who's into torture porn. He buys snuff films. Actual, like, realistic snuff, like, real snuff films. Not realistic, but real. Like, he watches people get tortured to death. And he buys this new video, and he recognizes the chick that is in the video that's getting tortured to death. And then it turns out that it's fake, and, you know, he thought that he knew her because he thought he had dated her in college. And then he's on the street a few days later, and I'm, like, reading this story thinking, okay, I know exactly where this is going, right? Exactly, precisely where this is going. This guy is going to get tortured to death by the end of the story. And he is walking down the street, he lives in New York City, and he sees the chick that he used to date in college, and she's older, of course, but he recognizes her, and they set up a dinner date, they go to dinner, and they talk, and she brings him back to her house, and then, you know, it starts up, you know, the bad shit starts to roll in, and the guy winds up getting tortured to death. Which Jack Ketchum doesn't, you know, elucidate on the torture that the guy undergoes. He just, you know, leaves it at, you know, this shit's about to happen. You know what's about to happen. I can just end it here. She's about to get her revenge because he treated her like shit, back in college. But it's played 100% straight. You know, there's zero wink and nod in Jack Ketchum's writing that I've been able to discover so far. And it was the exact same way with H.P. Lovecraft. He was playing his stories 100% straight. When you go read At the Mountains of Madness, there's no looking at the camera in there. There's no fourth wall breaks. There's no, isn't this all silly? It's 110%, you know, this is horrifying. Whereas, you know, you read a lot of people who write, quote-unquote, Cthulhu mythos Lovecraftian stories, which, by the way, just as an aside, if anything bills itself as Lovecraftian, run. Run away. Leave. Go away. This person does not understand what they are talking about. They do not understand what they are writing, and it's going to be shit. Just saying. But with these people that are reimagining H.P. Lovecraft and reclaiming H.P. Lovecraft, they do the wink and nod shit with their stories, and it's really fucking annoying. That's why H.P. Lovecraft is still famous, and you've probably never heard of any of these other people. So people are just sick of it. Just stop. Just fucking stop. And I think that another reason that people were confusing that one guy who was being a dick on Twitter with people who actually worked on the show, thinking that that guy worked on the show, was because he was defending the show as like, oh, let's just stop this show and put all of these talented artists and writers and shit out of work. Which, you know, usually that only comes from people who are worried about their job. So, you know, once again, I understand why people think that guy's working on the show. But, like I said, people are just tired of it, man. We don't want subversive fiction anymore. Nobody does. You know who wants subversive fiction? The people who read J.D. Salinger and liked it. The people who just want to seem smarter than everybody else. The people who have to be the smartest guys in the room all the fucking time. Those are the people who like subversive fiction. The dickhead in high school who just had to be smarter than everybody else. And the adult who never grew up beyond that. And, you know, people shit on the pulps all the time about how lowbrow and how they appealed to the common man and shit like that. And, you know, even this is gonna transfer into another thing that I wanted to talk about. But I recently bought this biography of Robert E. Howard, the guy who wrote Conan. And I really, really like it because this guy who actually wrote the biography really respects Robert E. Howard. He really loves this guy's work. He really is enamored with Robert E. Howard in a way that I wish I was, to an unhealthy fucking degree. But the guy who wrote the intro for this, Joe R. Lansdale, that's his name. Joe R. Lansdale, in this intro, he talks about how he's not overly fond of the pulps. He even says, like Lovecraft, a writer who I'm not overly fond of, but whose impact, like Howard's, is undeniable. He seems to, you know, be giving grudging respect to Robert E. Howard. Let me see. Yeah, shit like this. The 12-year-old male was perhaps his most obvious mark, being open to all the desires, the repressed desires that Howard displays, but readers of all ages have fallen under his spell. His characters, like most of that era, were primarily male, and when they were not, the view was unquestionably a masculine and often a chauvinistic one. Then again, Hemingway would have to bow guilty to this as well, and where Papa Hemingway could become overly precious and even embarrassing in his attempts to present male and female discourse, Howard at least knew what he could do and what he could not. You know, and then he's immediately after that, he says, but again, comparisons fall weakly and silently aside. Howard was Howard, and the situation is this. Howard should be better known not only as a creator of Blood and Thunder, but as a writer of importance and impact. So it's like, you know, oh, he did all of this, you know, lowbrow, dirty shit for the common peasants and little boys and things like his writing is primarily directed towards little boys. But regardless of that, it's actually quite popular and has a massive effect on, you know, literature as we know it and shit like that. It's like, okay, dude, I understand that you don't like his work, all right? I get that you don't respect Robert E. Howard, but you're pretending that you do, all right? I get it. You know, you can just come out and say, you should have said, I'm not qualified. I don't like this guy. I don't like his writing. You know, I'm not a fan of Conan. I'm not a fan of the pulps. I've just set it aside. Let somebody else who actually knows what the fuck they're talking about write that intro. And it's the exact same thing with this Thundercats Roar thing. You know, let's step aside. Step the fuck aside and let somebody who actually liked the old show take this over. This is not your thing. This is not your thing to remake. It's not your thing to reimagine. It's not your thing to fucking subvert like this and turn into a garbage fire that nobody's going to watch. And then you're going to get upset and you're going to cry that nobody's watching your thing when it looks like shit and it plays like shit and it shits on the old show and you personally are shitting on the fans on your Twitter feed. You have nobody to blame but yourself. Just saying, dude. Stop this subversive bullshit. Subversive is crap. I would personally advise anybody who is sick of this shit to just stop consuming it altogether. Like, when I get that hint of the subversive in a book, it ruins it for me. This is part of the reason that I could not finish Fight Club. The book is awful. It is god-fucking-awful. It is one of the worst written novels I've ever read in my entire life. It's all so angsty and, like, Limp Bizkit is basically the best way that it is angry white boy, the fucking book. That's it. And I know, of course, that there is the whole thing about Fight Club where it's these guys who don't, Jesse Lucas could explain it better than I could, frankly, but it's these guys who don't understand the society that they're in and they regress to a cult-like mentality of violence and totemism. And they become a chaos cult, essentially. Which, I get that in the movie. In the movie, that comes across really well. Fight Club is a really good movie. But the book, it just gets bogged down in this pretentious, oh, I hate my life, and everything sucks, and I don't have any direction, and I don't know what to do about it, and I don't know how to figure out what to do about it, and I don't even want to start to figure out what to do about it. I would rather just kill myself. Well, fucking do it, faggot. Do us all a favor and neck yourself. And I'm not talking to anybody in specific. This is directed towards the protagonist of Fight Club. But just stop consuming media like that. You know, I can't do it anymore. I've been spoiled. I went on a binge and started reading all of the Conan stories because it's a damn shame that I haven't read them all yet. It's actually criminal as much as I love Robert E. Howard. So I'm going through and I'm reading all of Howard's Conan stories and I am getting spoiled on this shit. It's just so honest and earnest and just straight up action adventure heroism bad fucking assery. And of course it's you know, put through Howard's lens of civilization bad, barbarism good. Civilization is often more barbaric than barbarism. But at the end of the day, these are really straight hero stories. You know, and I don't mean straight as in sexuality. I mean, they're played straight. You know, there's none of the wink and nod. And I just can't deal with the shit that winks and nods anymore. And I don't think you should either. I don't think we should put up with this kind of shit. If you are pissed off about Thundercats Roar, then you're probably pissed off about Star Wars The Last Jedi. And you're probably pissed off about Teen Titans Go. And you're probably pissed off about the way that Marvel has been trending with their comic book division in the past few years. And how the movies are starting to trend now with the announcement of Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, coming into the movie franchise. As opposed to staying in the den of iniquity and sin in the comic books where she fucking belongs. Which, I called that shit, by the way. By the way, I called that shit. When I stopped watching Marvel movies, I talked to people. I would have conversations with people. And they would be like, yeah, but the movies are still, the comics suck, but the movies are still okay. And I'm sitting here like, motherfucker, if you don't think that this shit is coming into the movies soon, you're delusional. You are 100% fucking delusional, and you are setting yourself up for a huge disappointment, like, 3 years down the road. And lo and behold, I'm right again. There's plenty of times where I'm wrong, but don't bet against me on that shit, because I saw it coming. I called it. Did I call it? Yes, I fucking did. So just stop consuming this shit. And like I say, if you want to go and voice your displeasure on social media, that's perfectly fine. Do that. I encourage it. I'm actually kind of glad that this whole Thundercats Roar thing has happened, because this is going to shake up some normies. you know, for the longest time, we've been doing this whole culture war thing, and it's been kind of underground. You know, a little bit is overt, a little bit is underground. You know, we had Gamergate and shit like that, and people realized that these people were creeping into the games industry. And they started fighting back against them, and they started getting fed up with all the practices that these people put into their art, quote-unquote, if you want to generously call it that. And they started fighting back against it, and they started not consuming this shit actively. And then people are doing the same thing in literature with the Sad Puppies and the Rabid Puppies movements, and now Pulp Rev, the Pulp Revolution, which is something that I'm a part of. Actively going out there and doing it on my Steemit page, hopefully one story a week. I'm going to start ramping up production on that, but we're tired of all of this shit. We're tired of the way that the Hugos and the Nebulas and magazines like Clark's World and the Magazine of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Asimov's and, you know, all of the rest of these, the reboot of Weird Tales that completely miss the fucking point of Weird Tales. We're tired of it. And now it's starting to get into more widely accepted venues, like movies with Star Wars and cartoons with Thundercats. A lot of people watch Thundercats. A lot of people liked Thundercats. And when you start fucking with the things that they like, they start to get upset. This has shaken up a lot of normies. And like I say, I'm almost glad that it has, because now people are starting to be in open revolt against this kind of shit. You know, we saw Ghostbusters, we see Star Wars, and now we have Thundercats. And it's really, like, galvanizing the other side of the culture war. Like, a lot more people are getting on this whole fuck these people train. Especially with the rise of independent media that will actually report on things, like how the creators have responded to the criticism that they're getting for making the Thundercats look like Steven fucking Universe. It's shaken people up, and that's a good thing. Because now a lot more people will get quote-unquote woke, red-pilled, or however the fuck you want to put it, to what's actually been going on in the entertainment industries over the past, like, 30 years. So now it's not some niche thing like video games, which is absolutely not a niche thing. Everybody plays fucking video games. It's the biggest industry in entertainment. It pulls down more per year than the film industry does. But most people don't really care about video games because there's enough of a selection out there that you can find something that will appeal to you. With movies, a little bit harder. You know, you have to... movies take a lot of money to produce and shit like that, so the shit that comes into the theaters, if it starts becoming this low-quality bullshit, like The Last Jedi or Ghostbusters reboot or something like that, people start to notice. People start to take heed. Even, you know, with... it happens as well with cartoons. You know, that's something... That's going to be on Cartoon Network, fam. A lot of people watch Cartoon Network. I don't anymore. I haven't watched Cartoon Network in fucking years, but that's because they stopped playing all of their good shows. I think the last gasp of worthwhile shit that Cartoon Network had was the last season of Samurai Jack, which I still have yet to watch, because I'm just not all that confident in it. I've heard that it was really good. I'm just not all that confident. I don't know. I'm going to watch it eventually, but it's one of those things. But this is shaking up a lot of people. A lot of people are really pissed off. And all of the shills and all of the excoriations and all of the blocking on Twitter will not save these people from the whirlwind that they have reaped. So, all right, I don't have the sponsors up, so I'm going to go ahead and get that shit. And then I'll get into basically filleting Robert E. Howard for, I don't know, a half hour or so. But just let me bring this up and I'll do the first round of sponsors here. All right, well, if you enjoy what I do here and you want to help support me, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. First up, we have the Maker Support. Now, Maker Support has been engaged in not exactly shady behavior lately, but they had some problems with their payment processing that they weren't upfront about, and I think they've got it fixed, but I haven't heard a whole lot about that. The Maker Support's still open. If you want to go over there and drop some shekels in the hat, then that's perfectly cool. You can totally do that. It's up to you whether or not you want to trust Maker Support. I also now have a Ko-fi, which is K-O-F-I, which is basically just a PayPal tip jar. So if, you know, you want to drop some shekels in the hat, then you can go over to Ko-fi and you can toss me a couple of bucks if you like what I do. I would be most appreciative, and I probably will use it to buy coffee. Next up, we have the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks. These are some good old Superversive. As I said, the Superversive is where it's at. military science fiction, in the vein of, I would class it as Star Trek meets Firefly. It also has a strong female character, if you are into that sort of thing. I am. And I greatly enjoyed these books. I did 6, 7, and 8 in the series, and I started at book 7, so you don't have to start at number 1. I would recommend that you start at book 1, because the guy who writes them, Andrew Beery, is a very good author, and I really just enjoy the shit out of this series. Like, in between doing book 8 and book 6, I went and I bought the audiobooks for the entire rest of the series and just absolutely adored them. So if you're looking for some good military science fiction with interesting aliens and some kick-ass lore and shit that just builds on itself but doesn't really succumb to DBZ syndrome, then this is the book series for you. Next up, we have the Dimension Bucket Media books, which include Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is a collection of spooky microfiction by Hell Richards. And there is a whole bunch of stories in this anthology, and none of them will take you over 5 minutes to read. It's some very good horror writing. I'm very interested in Hell's work, and I'm looking forward to the next book that she puts out, which I'm told she is working on. So look forward to Hell's next release. Dimension of Cobwebs is an anthology of weird fiction from the days when weird fiction was first becoming a thing, featuring grandmasters of the craft such as H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, H.G. Wells, Hans Heinz Ewers, Bram Stoker, and I want to say there's one other guy, but I can never remember the full list. But if you want to find out where weird fiction came from, where the origins of weird fiction started, this is where you want to go to get that. Darkest of Dreams is an anthology by the Dimension Bucket Media crew of horror fiction, so if you want to go and find out our different takes on the horror genre, then you can pick that one up. We recently did a little bit of editing to that, gave it a nice, slick new cover, and everything should be up on Amazon now. So if you want to go check that one out, then we would really appreciate it. And I think you'll very much enjoy our different takes on the horror genre. A Man Upstairs is a collection of creepy dark verse by Christopher Warren, who is neither a poet nor does he like freeform poetry, so of course he wrote a book of it. And it's been getting pretty good reviews, and I am not a poetry guy, but I like what I've read of this so far, in the kind of, you know, intellectual sense of, oh, this is nice, you know, I still don't really get poetry on like a spiritual, visceral level. I've tried, but it just doesn't click. But I like this, so if I like it, you'll probably like it too, especially if you're into dark poetry. Cracked by Connor Goff, that's C-R-A-C-K apostrophe D, is the story of a man who discovers a horrible secret behind reality and has to find out what's going on before reality starts falling apart around him. Connor has a good way of playing with madness in his stories, where you're not really sure if everything is just going on in his head or if it's actually happening. So if you're into stories like that, go ahead and pick up Cracked by Connor Goff. Phoenix on the Sword is the first ever published Conan story by Robert E. Howard, my personal deity. So if you want to find out why I'm so nutty about Robert E. Howard, go and pick this book up. Conan is king of Aquilonia. It is later in his life, and there is a plot to assassinate and depose him and install a puppet government in his stead. And there is a subplot with a Stygian warlock who summons a baboon demon, and Conan goes on a dream quest under a mountain to get a magic sword, and he winds up fighting the demon, and it's just primo sword and sorcery action adventure fic. Go read this book. All right, that's it for the first round of sponsors. So, like I said earlier, I have been binging on Robert E. Howard stories. I have a collection, an audiobook collection of his horror stories that I've been reading, and I've just been absolutely devouring the fucking Conan stories. And one thing that I really don't understand is how people can denigrate Robert E. Howard as a bad writer. As far as I'm concerned, Robert E. Howard is the best writer that America has ever produced, period. And I've read a lot of them. You know, I've read Lovecraft, I've read Kerouac, I've read King, I've read, you know, Miller, Henry Miller, I've read Hermann Hesse, I've read all of these different writers. You know, I've got bookshelves and bookshelves and bookshelves full of American authors that I've been reading since I was a little kid. And Robert E. Howard is the best one. He just fucking is. It's complete. Once you go and read his stories, it's undeniable. And I'm not just shilling for our Dimension Bucket Media publication of Phoenix on the Sword here. I'm dead ass serious. Like, I talked about this with James Bennett,
before he went off to fucking Asia to become a Shaolin monk or whatever the fuck he's doing. And he brought up the Hour of the Dragon, which is the last Conan story. And I mean the last one, because we don't count pastiches and fan fiction and shit like that here. No, but it's the original bust. And he brought up that in the Hour of the Dragon, it has the most terrifying depiction of necromancy that he has ever encountered. Wherein the necromancy not just raised dead people back to life, it was reforming and reshaping the land itself to be the land from 3,000 or so years from the point of the story, back in time to when the necromancer was originally alive. So he wasn't just resurrecting dead people, he was resurrecting an entire period of history and just, like, superimposing it over Hyboria. And I was actually reading some shit earlier today that just, I can give you an example of why I think Robert E. Howard is the best writer. Just let me grab my Kindle right fast. I'll be right back. So I got it up, but there was one part of this while I was exercising that I was reading this morning that was just so fucking evocative. Like, that's the watchword for Robert E. Howard, is evocative. His writing is evocative. When he writes something, you see it. And there's zero exposition in his stories. Well, okay, that's not entirely true. There's a little bit of exposition every now and again. But for the most part, he reveals things as they are necessary to be known. You know what I mean? Like, when it becomes necessary in the story for you to know something, he will reveal it in such a way that it doesn't feel like it's exposition. Okay, here's a good passage. I'm just going to read, and then we'll comment on this as it goes along, which technically makes this fair use. So Conan is basically fighting a giant ape right now. The moonlight scene swam to Olivia's sight. This then was the end of the trail. For what human being could withstand the fury of that hairy mountain of thews and ferocity? Yet, as she stared in wide-eyed horror at the bronzed figure facing the monster, she sensed a kinship in the antagonist that was almost appalling. This was less a struggle between man and beast than a conflict between two creatures of the wild, equally merciless and ferocious. With a flash of white tusks, the monster charged. The mighty arms spread wide as the beast plunged, stupefyingly quick for all his vast bulk and stunted legs. Conan's action was a blur of... This is something that I particularly enjoyed, because it reminds me of, like, Dragon Ball Z and shit like that. Like, oh, I couldn't even see him move! That kind of shit. Just, I love that kind of shit, man. You know, I even liked it as a kid back when I was watching DBZ. It's like, oh, Goku is so fast! I can't even follow this fight! He's just... They're zipping all around the battlefield, and, you know, you have to have an extremely high power level to follow what's going on, and... That's just a lot of fucking fun to me. Conan's action was a blur of speed Olivia's eye could not follow. She only saw that he evaded that deadly grasp, and his sword, flashing like a jet of what... Pay very close attention to how Howard phrases this, okay? And tell me that you don't see this shit happening in your fucking head. And his sword, flashing like a jet of white lightning, sheared through one of those massive arms between the shoulder and elbow. A great spout of blood deluged the sword as the severed member fell, twitching horribly. But even as the sword bit through, the other malformed hand locked in Conan's black mane. Only the iron neck muscles of the Cimmerian saved him from a broken neck that instant. His left hand darted out to clamp on the beast's squat throat. His left knee was jammed hard against the brute's hairy belly. Then began a terrific struggle, which lasted only seconds, but which seemed like ages to the paralyzed girl. The ape maintained his grasp in Conan's hair, dragging him toward the tusks that glistened in the moonlight. The Cimmerian resisted this effort, with his left arm rigid as iron, while the sword in his right hand, wielded like a butcher knife, sank again and again into the groin, breast, and belly of his captor. The beast took its punishment in awful silence, apparently unweakened by the blood that gushed from its ghastly wounds. Swiftly, the terrible strength of the anthropoid overcame the leverage of braced arm and knee. Inexorably, Conan's arm bent under the strain. Nearer and nearer he was drawn to the slavering jaws that gaped for his life. Now the blazing eyes of the barbarian glared into the bloodshot eyes of the ape. But as Conan tugged vainly at his sword, wedged deep in the hairy body, the frothing jaws snapped spasmodically shut, an inch from the Cimmerian's face, and he was hurled to the sward by the dying convulsions of the monster. Olivia, half-fainting, saw the ape heaving, thrashing and writhing, gripping manlike the hilt that jutted from its body. A sickening instant of this, then the great bulk quivered and lay still. Conan rose and limped over to the corpse. The Cimmerian breathed heavily, and walked like a man whose joints and muscles have been wrenched and twisted almost to their limit of endurance. He felt his bloody scalp and swore at the sight of the long, black, red-stained strands still grasped in the monster's shaggy hand. You know, you can just, you can see all of this happening as Howard is describing it. You know, when I said evocative, I fucking meant it. And I've been taking serious notes from this motherfucker while I've been reading his stories over the past few days. And that's kind of what I mean with the difference between the wink and nod and playing it straight. There's no meta to this. Like, there's a little bit of meta at the beginning of the fight when Olivia is looking at Conan and the ape and saying that, oh, these two aren't so different, basically is her kind of overall analysis of things. You know, they're two creatures of the wild locked in Mortal Kombat. But that phrasing that he uses, like his sword flashing like a jet of white lightning, that kind of shit. Just, there's no pretension here. There is zero pretension. And this is one of the things that I have a serious fucking problem with. This is why I couldn't finish Fight Club. Fight Club is the most pretentious book I have ever stuck my nose in. It's horrible. It's trying to be edgy. It really is, and it is so try-hard about it. It's not like, you know, what's the name of it? John Dies at the End. Where, you know, okay, this is kind of edgy, and he does some subversive things with it, and he actually does some shit that I wouldn't expect David Wong to do, given that he's the fucking, you know, he was the editor-in-chief at Cracked, and we all know how fucking downhill Cracked has gone. There's a point in John Dies at the End in the second book. This book is full of spiders, seriously, dude, don't touch it. Where there's this old white guy and this black dude, and they're having a conversation on how to escape from this military compound. And the guy just casually refers to the black guy as a nigger. Just out of fucking nowhere. Like, it just, well, nigger? Like, it's just like it's his name. Like, shit like that. Like, you wouldn't expect David Wong to pull some crap like that. But there's plenty of shit in the John Dies at the End books that are, as much as I like them, that is that wink and nod, that's that meta, you know, isn't this silly? Isn't this kind of ridiculous? I mean, it still maintains that whole, you know, terrifying aspect to it, because at the end of the day, those are horror books. But there's that levity to it, where it's like, yeah, things are really serious and it's really bad, but we can still make light of the situation. With Robert E. Howard, there's none of that bullshit. It's just, it's horrible and it's bad, and Conan's gonna fix shit with a sword. And this kind of shit is why I prefer Robert E. Howard to the incredibly vast majority of writers, period. You know, not just new writers, but even writers of his day, or even further back. Just, I legitimately think that he is the greatest author that America has ever produced. I think it's entirely possible that he's the greatest author who ever lived. Because as the author of the biography that I'm reading stated, Robert E. Howard grew up in a time where things were shifting in Texas. It was basically when the oil boom was happening and, you know, the gold boom had passed and now people were out here looking for oil in Texas. So his family shipped around a lot and he saw a lot of bullshit. Remember, the guy only lived to be 30 years old. He saw a lot of bullshit about the way that oil booms work and the crime and just nasty shit that happens when quote-unquote civilization comes to previously rural areas. And he hated it. So rather than go and do that shit, rather than go and work on an oil field or something like that, he would spend like 12 hours a day at his typewriter and just pump out these stories almost instinctually. And it shows. You know, whereas somebody like me, I'm very concerned with how often I use certain words.
you know, like, in my mech stories, I'm very careful. Like, I try to vary up the way that I refer to the machines, and, you know, in Bringing Down the Mountain, I try to vary up how I refer to the creatures that they're fighting, you know, monsters, creatures, beasts, demons. I use all of this different kind of hopefully evocative language so that I avoid belaboring people with just calling them monsters. Because reading the same word over and over and over again in a story, you know, it gets boring. Now, I have that luxury because I'm not writing for magazines. You know, I'm not necessarily... I mean, I'm trying to write to put bread on the table, but I'm not doing that right now. Or I'm not in the position to do that right now. Now, that's changing here in a little bit, so you guys might notice some of this shit creeping into my own stories. Because, like I say, there are only a few writers nowadays that I take notes from. And Robert E. Howard is a big one. This guy created some of the most enduring characters ever. You know, Robert E. Howard and Edgar Rice Burroughs are two of, and H.P. Lovecraft, are probably the three greatest authors that America has ever produced. And I would say that they're in the order of, at the top, Howard, then Lovecraft, then Burroughs. And the way that I know some people might get pissed off at me about that, but the reason that I put them in that order is because Howard's characters are not only still getting movies, they're also still getting comics, they're also still getting pastiches written about them, they're also getting all of this bullshit. Red Sonja, even though that's not a Howard character, Red Sonja was created to be a counterpart to Conan by somebody else. He wasn't created by Howard. She wasn't created by Howard, so far as I know. I should probably look that up, actually, just so I'm not, you know, completely wrong about that. Yeah, she was created by writer Roy Thomas and artist Barry Windsor Smith for Marvel Comics in 1973, partially based on Robert E. Howard's own creation, Red Sonja of Rogatino, a female swashbuckler from his 1934 story, The Shadow of the Vulture. Sonja with a Y was Howard's creation, but Sonja with a J was these two guys from Marvel. But it's based on Robert E. Howard's stories. But Red Sonja is still getting comics made about her. Conan is still getting comics. There was one recently that came out that was Conan and Wonder Woman. They did a crossover because Dynamite owns the rights for Conan, but they recently reverted to Marvel, I think. Marvel got the rights for Conan, unfortunately. But yeah, Conan is still getting comics. Conan is still getting movies. There was a recent Conan movie that came out that I have not watched because I absolutely refuse to believe that anybody who touches Howard's stories is able to deliver them faithfully in any other medium, unless I'm just, like, missing the Richard Linklater of Robert E. Howard. Which, Richard Linklater is the only filmmaker who has ever made a good Philip K. Dick adaptation. Period, the end, fuck your Blade Runner, okay? Okay, he's not the only one. The Electric Ant with Gary Sinise, that was a really good, faithful adaptation of that story. But so far as everything else, like Blade Runner, Man in the High Castle, it's all shit compared to the actual Philip K. Dick stories. Richard Linklater's rendition of A Scanner Darkly is one of the only faithful Philip K. Dick adaptations. So there may be someone like Richard Linklater out there who has worked with Howard's characters and stories in the same way that Linklater has. But even like the 1980s Conan movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's not Conan. It's Kull. It's Kull of Atlantis. It's reskinned Kull. They basically stripped the skin off of Kull and put Conan onto him and said, this is a Conan story. Which it fucking isn't. Kull's backstory is the whole, you know, you killed my father, prepare to die thing. It's his parents were murdered and he went out to seek revenge. Conan's backstory is he was bored. Literally, that's it. I'm dead ass fucking serious. Go read them if you don't believe me. Go read Robert E. Howard's Conan stories. Conan's backstory is that he grew up in Samaria and it's a hard, rocky, loveless, fucking joyless country. It sucks. And he would sit on the mountains in Samaria and look out over the world and know that there was shit going on out there and wanted to see what it was. So he just left one day and went out and became an adventurer and a mercenary and a pirate and a thief and a king. That's Conan's backstory. So nobody has been able to do Conan right. so far as I've been able to determine. Even, like, pastiches, they still miss the point. And you can see this in HP from Everyday Should Be Tuesday. He's at Tuesday Reviews on Twitter. He did a Summer of Conan last year. And he went over, like, a bunch of pastiches and shit, and you can tell from his reviews of the Conan pastiches, like, the novels that appeared in, like, the 70s and the 80s, you can just tell that nobody was able to capture that same fire that Robert E. Howard did. He was the only guy to properly bottle that particular bolt of lightning. And because Howard would sit at his typewriter for, like, 12 hours a day and just type out these stories like Conan and Sailor Steve Costigan and Cull and Solomon Kane, it just feels instinctual for him. Like, all of these stories, like I mentioned, there's a lot of repeats in Robert E. Howard's stories, a lot of echoes, words that are repeated a lot, like thews. Conan's mighty thews, talking about, like, his physical strength, his arms and his legs and shit. He uses that phrase a lot, to the point where that's, like, that word is associated with Robert E. Howard. He's probably used it more than anybody else. You know, and there's also various descriptions. Like, he likes to use animal comparisons a lot. Like, Conan's pantherish stride, or, you know, crouching like a jungle cat, or like a wolf, or things like that. He compares people to animals. I think because that's very evocative, and people know instantly what you're talking about. When you compare somebody to a wolf, when you say he has a wolfish grin, people know what the fuck you mean. People understand wolves. That's an instinctual thing that's buried deep within the consciousness of mankind. Because long ago, we used to exist where wolves were a real fucking danger to literally everybody. And those stories get passed down, even to the point of folk tales, like the Three Little Pigs, or Little Red Riding Hood, you know, the Brothers Grimm. They played with wolf imagery a lot. So we all kind of understand this on an instinctual level. When he compares Conan to a panther, you know, you get exactly what he's talking about with how Conan is moving. And one thing that I'm just finding totally absent in Howard's work is pretension. Because he didn't have time for it. He was writing to pay the bills. He was, like I said, at his typewriter, sometimes for 12 hours a day, just churning out these stories that were meant to entertain people. And the problem that I have with dickheads like Lansdale, who wrote the intro for Blood and Thunder, which is the biography of Robert E. Howard that I'm currently reading, the problem that I have with dickheads like him is that he is trapped in this mentality of pretension, where everything has to have a deeper meaning. And if you don't have this deeper political or philosophical meaning to your stories, then they're just not worth it. They're just not good stories. If they appeal to 12-year-old boys, then they're not worth your time. And this is a kind of mentality that actively pisses me off beyond words. Just beyond fucking description. It gets under my fucking skin because these people don't remember how to have fun. And they shit on other people for having a good time. Even if it's not, like, actively, oh, you enjoy that, you're so stupid. Even if it's not something to that level, it's still that air of I'm better than you because I don't like this thing that you like. And for the reasons that you like it, that's why I don't like it. You think that this is great because it has good action and adventure and heroism and love and romance, and that stuff is all so passé. What's really woke, what's really in vogue is, you know, being a pretentious dickhead. I should probably give a better example of being a pretentious dickhead. Okay, so Ulysses. Ulysses is a novel, loosely a novel. I wouldn't classify it as a novel. I would classify it as an extended jack-off sequence. But Ulysses is a novel written by... I bother with this guy so little, I can't even remember his fucking name. Ulysses novel, here we go. James Joyce, that's his name. Now, James Joyce was an insufferable fucking prick. This is the guy who was quoted as saying, something along the lines of, other authors ask their readers to read their fiction,
I ask my readers to understand my life before they could even begin to understand my fiction, or something like that. And this kind of mentality is just so fucking up its own ass. And I can't stand it. It's like all of the people who like Catcher in the Rye. Why? Why do you like this book? Is it because you can jack yourself off to how smart you fucking are? I think that's why people like that kind of writing. Or they claim to like it. You know, you get these people, oh, I read J.D. Salinger. I read Catcher in the Rye. It's one of the greatest American novels of all time. And then, you know, you can tell that these guys are just putting on airs. They're just trying to appear intelligent. They're trying to look like the smartest guy in the room. They're not trying to actually be entertained. And to quote Bradford Walker, the first duty of fiction is to entertain above all else. If you want to put political messaging or religious messaging or whatever the fuck in it, you're more than welcome to do that. But if it's not entertaining, then it's not worth anybody's fucking time. Joyce is not entertaining on any level. Period. The end. It's not entertaining. That's why there's never been a movie made about Ulysses. No one's ever tried to adapt that into a movie because it's not fucking entertaining. Meanwhile, Conan has like fucking 4 movies. He's got hundreds of comic books. He's got hundreds of pastiches where people have tried to imitate Robert E. Howard because Conan is an entertaining character and Robert E. Howard's stories are entertaining. You know, even when you get into the stuff that's not as well known, you know, putting aside Solomon Kane and Conan, when you get into like Sailor Steve Costigan or his lesser known horror stories, they're entertaining, first and foremost. That's what he wrote them for, because the pulp magazines of the time were sold. They earned their living. They earned their right to exist based on entertaining people. That's why Weird Tales and Argosy were around for so long, because they were so good at finding writers who entertained their readers. So if your first goal isn't to entertain, then your shit is garbage. Just out the gate. Period. The end. I have no fucking time for it. I'm not here to listen to your pretentious screed dressed up as fiction about how people should be more accepting to trans people or how racism is bad for the fucking 900 bajillionth goddamn time. I'm done. I'm done with that shit. It's not entertaining. I've heard this shit before way too many fucking times, okay? I read R.A. Salvatore when I was a kid, when I was in high school. I read R.A. Salvatore. I read the Drizzt books. You know, I kept up with that shit. I got my racism is bad narrative from him. Now, granted, R.A. Salvatore's books are actually entertaining. You know, they're actually good hero stories. But he has to shoehorn that fucking racism is bad narrative into every single story he fucking tells for some reason. It's like, we got it, dude. We got it. We understand. Racism is bad. We get it. You know, okay. You can calm down now. But with Howard, there's none of that. There's no pretension. The only message that you could probably pry out of this that's obvious on the face of it. Like, if you want to go digging for shit in Howard, then you're probably just imprinting onto the story what you want to see. Like, for example, this is kind of a stupid example, but recently I wrote this story, like this week, as a matter of fact. I'm writing this story that I'm tentatively calling Death Flowers, and it's about a demon ninja woman, demon Kunoichi. And I was talking about it on Twitter, like, oh my god, how do I end this story? It's just normal writer kvetching. But Nice Weeb got in touch over Twitter, and he was just like, well, you know, is this like a big titty Kunoichi, or is this flat chest? I don't know. This guy's got weird fucking taste. He's he needs help. But he asked me like what she looked like, and I was like, dude, I don't have time for that shit. I'm telling an adventure story here. This is an action story. This is like a romance between her and this handsome samurai that I did not plan on showing up at all, but there he fucking is. You know, I didn't plan on how big her titties are. You know, if you want like your small short stack, you know, ninja Kunoichi demon girl GF, go for it. I don't fucking care. If you want like, you know, flat chest, go for it. If you want big titties, go for it. You know, however you envision this character, I don't care. That's just as good as, I have my own picture of this character in my head, but I neglected to put that in the story because that level of description just would have detracted from the overall thing, and it's not necessary. So you can envision this character any way that you like.
You know, now, with Howard, he, of course, had, you know, distinct descriptions of his character, so you know what Solomon Kane looked like. You know what Conan looked like. But apart from that, there's none of that pretension to Howard's stories, where he has to describe every single little thing down to the most minute detail and just bog the story down. He couldn't. He couldn't, because his stories were meant to entertain people and be fast-moving action stories. So he had to make entertainment his primary goal. And I think that he succeeded in every story that I have ever heard or read of his. Because, like I say, I got the audiobook. But, yeah, every Robert E. Howard story that I've ever read or listened to has had that complete lack of pretension to it. He's not asking anybody to understand his life. I'm going and reading this biography of Robert E. Howard because I idolize the man, and I wish I could write like he does, and I'm trying to be able to write like he does, but with my own twist and my own ideas and shit. But that kind of style of evocative, red-boned writing that just grabs the fucking reader by the fucking short hairs and pulls him in and says, all right, for the next 6,000 words, you're here with me. That's the kind of thing that I'm trying to accomplish with my own short fiction. And I want to understand how and why Howard wrote the way that he did. And that's why I'm going and reading this biography, because I have an unhealthy infatuation with Robert E. Howard. I'm still working on the shrine. I gotta get, like, a picture of him and a nice leather-bound copy of the Conan stories. And, like, I gotta travel to Texas and get a jar of dirt from the house that he lived in. And, you know, it's a whole involved... Creating a shrine is an involved business. But I just fucking idolize this dude. He is the best writer I have ever encountered. Because there's no message here. There's no ulterior motive to his stories. When Robert E. Howard presents a story to you, he sets this collection of words in front of you, however long it might be, and he just slides it across the table, gives it a nice little pat, and says, I hope this entertains you. And then he backs off and lets you be fucking entertained. With everybody else, it's like, okay, this is a commentary on racism, and I hope it entertains you. Or this is a, you know, like Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers is political philosophy dressed up as science fiction. I still like the book. I really like the book, but that's what it is. Let's be real here. They slide this across the table and they're like, you know, this is political philosophy with science fiction, and I hope it entertains you. Now, Robert E. Howard was all about entertainment from the fucking jump, fam. And that's what I want to be. That's what I want to do with my fiction, is fucking entertain people. You know, if people want to look at my shit and think, okay, well, he might be making a commentary on this or that, whatever, you can read all that shit in if you want. Did you like the story? That's all I fucking care about. You know, you can get into this pretentious dick measuring, you know, intellectual, how big is my intellectual cock kind of shit, if and you feel like it. I don't care for it. I don't put it into my fucking stories. And I'm getting that from Robert E. Howard. You know, so far as authors that I'm looking up to, I'm finding it drastically changed from where I was 7 years ago, just from basically getting Jeffro'd, from reading Jeffro's book and talking to the guy. I have a podcast with Jeffro up that was like from a year and a half ago. It's like 4 hours long, but I highly recommend that you guys go listen to it. Jeffro's a lot of fucking fun. I would love to have the guy on again. But yeah, I totally lost my fucking train of thought. The reason that I'm going back to these old guys like Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance and Roger Zelazny and Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft and Edgar Rice Burroughs is because when you look at the crop of science fiction and fantasy authors that are coming out now, like even my shit, like, okay, I've got a story that's never going to be released. I hate it. I hate it. When I wrote it, I thought it was just the best thing ever. But now, looking back on it, and I'll go ahead and give you guys a plot synopsis. It's about these two guys, because I had read something, I don't remember what the book was, but I had read something about somebody who was magically negative. Like, they literally could not be affected by magic at all. That was their thing. I might have been reading The Sword of Truth. That might be where I got that shit from. But I wanted to do something with that. So I created the story about these guys who, at the behest of the king, they went around and hunted down wizards. And one guy was a battle mage, so he was proficient in swordsmanship and magic. But he was looked down on by the Magician's College
because of course I had a magician's college. He was looked down on them because he also took up the sword. He didn't devote himself 100% to magic. And his partner was magically negative, so he could not be affected. Like, you would conjure a ball of acid that would, like, eat through any normal person and just throw it at this guy, and it would just splat onto his chest, and he would, like, wipe it off and just throw it on the ground and not be hurt at all. And they went around and hunted wizards, and then the guy got an assignment to go and hunt down his old mentor. And then at the end of the story, he kills his old mentor. And it's horrible, and I hate it, and I'm not doing any more stories like that, and I'm not publishing that, because fuck that. Fuck that story. It's a bad story. But that was where I was, because I was steeped in this culture of subversion, and just everything has to be dark and depressing and nasty all the fucking time, and it really doesn't. And guys like Howard and Lovecraft and Vance and Liber really show that it doesn't have to fucking be like that all the time. And really, stories that aren't that way are better, you know, especially with Howard. Because at the end of the day, you know that the hero of the story is going to win out. But there's even, Howard has done Lovecraftian stories before. He had extensive correspondence with H.P. Lovecraft. And there's one story, and I wish I could fucking remember it, but I can't, so we're going to pass on the name of it. But the basic plot is, this is a Lovecraftian story, so there's cosmic evil beings and shit, and it's existing in the attic of this house downtown, so it's kind of a Dunwich horror feel. And the guy's girlfriend, the main character's girlfriend, gets captured, and she's going to be fed to the thing upstairs, and the main character busts into the house with his dog, and he runs up there, and he gets a sword, and he fights off the thing. The Star Spawn, or whatever the fuck it is, the Cthulian monster. He fights it off with a sword, and he kills it, and then him and the girl, you know, supposedly live happily ever after. So even Robert E. Howard, who I'm touting as the best author of all time, could not do Lovecraft properly. But even with stories like that, there's zero pretension, there's none of the anything. Like, the guy is going to go and do the heroic thing and try to save his fucking girlfriend from the cosmic horror from beyond the stars, and he does it. And it's played 100% straight. And stories like that really are better. Even if they're kind of sad. Like, with Fofford and the Grey Mauser by Fritz Leiber. The first time, spoilers for a story that's fucking 60 years old, but, you know, the first time Fofford and the Mauser meet, which is a prequel that Leiber wrote after he had already written a whole bunch of other adventures with Fofford and the Mauser. In the prequel, these guys meet in Lankmar, and they have their women that they are in love with, and the Thieves Guild kills them. The Thieves Guild kills the women. So, at the end of the story, Fofford and the Mauser go on an absolute rampage in the Lankmar Thieves Guild and kill everybody. They just, like, bloody-handed, tear this place to shreds, fuck everybody. But once again, with that story, there's zero pretension to it. These guys are angry because their girlfriends have been killed. So they're going to go and reap bloody-handed revenge on the people that did it. So I know I'm delving into writing advice here, which, you know, advice is the worst kind of advice, but if you're going to start writing science fiction and fantasy, specifically science fiction, fantasy, and horror, drop the pretension. Stop trying to appeal to the literary crew, because literary shit does not appeal to people. It really doesn't. It's been driving people away for years and years and years and years and years. Decades. Since right about 1940, when Campbell became the editor at, I want to say, Astounding. That's when he started to push the magazine in a more serious direction. And Dan and QQ have a great video on this called The Ideological Conquest of Science Fiction, which is excellent, and I will link to it in the description. I'm actually going to download that so that I never fucking lose a copy, because I love that video, and it's really well researched. But you can see this kind of shit, this subversive shit, just creep into it. And they start maligning people, like Damon Knight starts maligning people like Lovecraft and Howard and Merritt, based on, like, their physical attributes. Like, Lovecraft was neurotic, and Abraham Merritt looked like a schmoo. And, you know, Robert E. Howard was so damaged that after his mother died, he fucking put a bullet in his brain.
That doesn't stop them from being better authors than you, dick. Screaming out my anger at a guy who's been dead for decades now. But this lack of pretension that these old school pulp writers brought, in my opinion, makes their fiction infinitely better than anything that you would find in a college English class or a high school English class or the literature set or anything that you'll find winning Hugo Awards nowadays. The Dragon Awards are a different story because people like Nick Cole and Brian Niemeyer have won Dragons and they absolutely fucking deserve it. I read Galaxy's Edge, Legionnaire, and Netherial from the Soul Cycle series. I'm still working on Soul Dancer, Brian. I'm still working on it. Don't worry. I'm gonna read it. You'll get a review eventually. But yeah, just like with Brian Niemeyer, you know, he has this incredibly well worked out cosmology to it. But at the same time, there's none of the wink and nod. There's none of the subversive shit there. It's all 100% played straight, and it's great. It's one of the best science fiction novels I've ever read in my lifetime. 30 years of consuming science fiction content via video games and cartoons and movies and TV shows and books and short stories and all of that shit. Netherial is one of the best I have ever encountered. And I really do understand why the people who try to denigrate the legacy of people like Howard and Lovecraft really just can't compare. I understand why. I'm not justifying why, but I understand why they try to denigrate their legacy. Because they're not that good. You know, people like Kat Rambo, who is the current president of the Science Fiction Writers of America, or John Scalzi, or, you know, pick your Laird Barron, whose work I've never read, but I'd never even heard of him before he decided to make an issue of my post, The Attempted Murder of Sword and Sorcery. You know, people like that, they're just not that good. Because these people don't have a creative bone in their body. Like, for example, Old Man's War by Scalzi is a rehash of, I want to say, The Forever War by Haldeman. I might be wrong about that. Somebody out there will have to correct me, because I haven't read Old Man's War, because I don't bother with Scalzi's absolute garbage fucking fiction. But Red Shirts. Red Shirts is a story that Scalzi wrote that's literally Star Trek fan fiction. That's literally what it fucking is. That won a Hugo, by the way. The same award that fucking Frank Herbert of Dune fame won. That Robert Heinlein of Starship Troopers fame won. That won a Star Trek fan fiction won a Hugo. If you were wondering how far the Hugos have fucking fallen. So when I come to a writer like Howard, specifically, you know, other writers fall into this category as well, but Howard is the one that I want to concentrate on because he's the one that I've been reading lately. When I come to a writer like Howard, and he has none of this pretension, he has none of this overarching message, he just wants to entertain you. Because when he was writing these stories, he was trying to put bread on the table, and if he couldn't entertain people, his lights were getting shut off and, you know, his bills weren't getting paid. So when I come to a writer like that, who asks nothing more than to be entertained by the story, it's night and fucking day. Like, I've got so many Warhammer 40k novels over there, like, I can see them right there on that shelf. I've got so many Warhammer 40k novels over there that I want to go and read, but in reality, when it comes down to brass tacks, I would rather read Conan, I would rather read Solomon Kane, I would rather read Sailor Steve Costigan than any Warhammer novel you could name. Fucking Gaunt's Ghosts, Eisenhorn, any of it. Because that shit is honest. Howard's stories are honest. They're just trying to entertain me. That's it. That's the entire fucking goal. And God, does he accomplish it. By fucking God. With some of the most evocative language that I've ever encountered in fiction. And honestly, I think that it has improved my own fiction. Just reading Robert E. Howard. Like, Dominique Line, the other day on Twitter, was doing this, post 777 thing, where you go to the seventh page of your work in progress, and you start at the seventh line, and then you post seven lines from your story, and you just, like, take a screen cap of it and post it on Twitter. And I was like, well, okay, like, it doesn't really work, because that would start, like, in the exact center of a paragraph and end in the middle of another one,
But here's a paragraph from my new work in progress. You know, this is the thing. It's extreme first draft, so be gentle, but this is the thing that I'm working on right now. And it was the Death Flowers, the Demon Kunoichi story. And one of the guys, Roy Halbick, responded to me, and he said that this was very evocative language, or something to that effect. He used the word evocative. And that's exactly what I was fucking going for. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to put the image into people's heads like Robert E. Howard did.
You know, I want the prose to flow and be almost poetic. Not exactly poetic, because I'm not a poet, and I don't understand poetry, and I don't get how to do that. But Robert E. Howard's prose is not poetry. As much as it can flow like a poem, it's not a poem. So I can take tips from Robert E. Howard's prose, or somebody like Jack Vance, who was far more concerned with the action and putting images into your head rather than, you know, trying to be pretentious. Even if you go and read The Dying Earth, which is about wizards, you know, there's plenty of action and adventure in those books. But the language is also very evocative. You know, when he talks about the excellent prismatic spray spell being used, it's just like you see the sparks coming out of this guy's hand and just perforating this dude and killing him instantly. So honestly, that's the biggest compliment that I could have gotten on my writing, especially for a work in progress that I hadn't, you know, I had written it in one night, but I hadn't actually gone in and edited anything about it. Because usually, this is one of those habits that I picked up from Stephen King, which I think that is actually a good piece of advice in on writing, is what Stephen King will do, or he did do with stories, I don't know if he still does it, but he would just blast through the manuscript, just write out the first draft, bind all of the pages with a piece of string, and then shove them into a desk drawer for 6 months. And then when 6 months was over, he would take the manuscript out, and he would go through with a red pen, and he would start picking out all of his mistakes that he could catch. Now, if you know anything about Stephen King, that guy needs an editor. He really fucking needs an editor. Really badly. But that advice is good. I don't think that you need to, I don't think that you need to take 6 months. Like, I have about 2 or 3 weeks. So what I'll usually do is I'll write the story, and then I'll let it cool for like 2 weeks. And then basically I've forgotten most of what I've written. And then I'll go through and I'll red pen it. And because I've been using the Lester Dent Pulp Fiction master plot formula that he came up with, I'm more concentrated on doing 6,000 word stories. I have 6,000 words to play with, give or take, because I'm not at the point yet where I can reliably get a story under 6,000 words. It's usually 100 or so over by the end of the writing process, the first draft. And then, you know, going through, I can pare it down. But if I can read Howard, and I can read Lovecraft, and I can read Zelazny and Vance and Leiber and all of these other guys, and I can learn specifically Howard so far as evocative prose goes, and I can learn how to make every word count while I'm writing, then there's far less room for error. You know, there's far less editing that has to be done to this story. There's far less everything post-actual writing. And if I can learn how to do that on an instinctual level, then I can ramp up my production and really start pumping stories out there. Which, you know, I'm doing that right now. I don't know why this devolved into me talking about my writing process. I've just been reading Howard and reading this biography of him and thinking about how to improve my own writing, because that's why I'm reading Howard. You know, I'm not just reading him because I enjoy the stories, which I do. I am entertained by these stories because they were built to entertain, and like I said, by God do they deliver. But I'm also taking notes on how he structures his sentences, and the kinds of words that he uses, and the way that he phrases things, and the kind of language that he brings into play that will put pictures into your head whether you want to see them or not. You know, and that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to bring to my own writing so that I can sit at my computer for fucking 6 or 8 hours a day and just write and come out with something serviceable by the end that's at least good, if not,
you know, fucking great, if not the next revolution in science fiction and fantasy. Because I'm not trying to be the next revolution in science fiction and fantasy. I'm just trying to write stories that entertain people. And honestly, if anybody wants to write stories that just fucking entertain people, go read Robert E. Howard. Yeah, I'm not even talking about Conan here. You know, you can read Solomon Kane, you can read Cull, you can read all of these other stories, his horror stories, all of that stuff. Read his stories and pay attention to how he writes. And try to start working those techniques into your own writing. That's fundamentally what the Pulp Rev is about. You know, we're not trying to ape the old masters. We're not trying to ape those who have come before us. We're not trying to put on the pulps as a skin and wear it around as, you know, like Buffalo Bill in fucking Silence of the Lambs. We're trying to look at how these people wrote and the kind of language that they used and the kind of techniques that they used in their stories and their prose and their approach to dialogue and their approach to character building and their approach to character dynamics and relationship dynamics, and work that into our own stories. And that, I think, is what any good writer should do. Which is why I don't have time for shit that's published nowadays. Like, Sifwa trash, I don't read it. I don't fucking read it. Shit that's winning Hugo Awards and Nebula Awards, I don't fucking read it. Because these people don't look at the masters of old and think, there's somebody that I should try to learn from. Not emulate, learn from. There's a difference. They don't look at these people and think, that's somebody that I should try to learn from. They look at that person and think, I'm not as good as them. I need to try to tear them down to my level so that I look better in comparison. Meanwhile, I'm sitting over here like, okay, I'm nowhere near Robert E. Howard's level. Not even fucking close. But I can get there. I can get there if I buckle down and I actually learn how to write properly. If I learn how to use evocative language, if I read his stories and I take notes, I can get as good as Robert E. Howard was. I might never get there, but I can get close enough to make my shit worth reading, at least. And I think I've about got a handle on it. I still need some work. You know, of course, I'm never going to write like these people because I didn't grow up in their environment. I'm not them. I'm not H.P. Lovecraft. I'm not Robert E. Howard. I'm never going to write exactly like those guys. But I can take lessons from them and then write like me. I can integrate what I learned from them into my own process and write stories that absolutely blow the fucking socks off of readers. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I think I'm getting there. I really do think I'm getting there. Because my last story that I published, Bringing Down the Mountain, which is under A Gundam for Us, apparently. I didn't realize I was doing A Gundam for Us, but apparently I am. For those of you who aren't familiar, A Gundam for Us is something that was started by Brian Niemeyer, who has noticed that there is a dearth of good mech fiction coming from the West, essentially. The people who brought you Battletech and, you know, shit like that. There's not that much good mech fiction coming out of the West. So he wants to change that, and he's galvanized several Pulp Rev writers, including Raul Nianzi and J.D. Cohen and myself, into writing some mech stories to do kind of mech for Americans, mech for the Pulp Rev set, mech for people who really just want to be entertained by a good stompy robot story. But with Bringing Down the Mountain, I got a lot of compliments on that story. You know, a lot of people read that story that, you know, people that are in my kind of, like, circle, but hadn't really commented on many of my stories before, that one really seemed to fucking grab them. They really seemed to fucking enjoy that story. And I think I'm getting closer. I think I've about got this formula nailed down. You know, it's a combination of the Lester Dent thing and reading people like Robert E. Howard and just kind of synthesizing all of this into my own special secret sauce. I hope is going to catapult my stories to the next level and make them really fucking entertaining to people. But all right, I've probably gone on about that long enough and I'm starting to get a little bit drunk. So I'm going to go ahead and do the last round of sponsors and I'm going to get out of y'all's hair because this has gone on for long enough. So, all right. Like I say, now we're getting into the point of the sponsor role where it's people who have helped me out, and you can help me out by helping them out. So first up is Aaron Clary. Aaron Clary is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com and has a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com. So if you have any questions, barring legal or medical advice, about life, the universe, and everything, then you can go and hit up Aaron Clary, and he will give you the straight dope, no bullshit, for a price. Yes, it is a paid service. You will have to pay him. But it's not an exorbitant fee. So if you have any questions like, should I date this girl? Should I go to college? What should I major in? Should I do X? Then go and hit up Aaron, and he will tell you what you should do. And if you don't listen to him and you get fucked up, then it's all your fault. Because he told you. He also has several books out, a few of which I have done the audiobooks for. Most recently, I did Poor Richard's Retirement, which is a treatise on how it is entirely possible to achieve retirement in today's financial environment for far less than people are telling you that you need. This answers several questions about retirement that I didn't even know that I had. So I highly recommend this book, and if you want to hear my dulcet tones reading it to you, then you can get this in audio on Amazon, or on Audible, I guess, would be the website. It's still owned by Amazon, but you get the idea. I also did Enjoy the Decline, Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States, which is exactly what it says on the tin if you're worried about the way that the country is going nowadays, and you probably should be, no lie. Then this book will teach you how to adjust your mentality and recognize what you can and can't control, and then take care of the things that you can control and not really worry so much about the things that you can't control and just enjoy the decline. Highly, highly recommended book. This is my favorite book by Aaron. I've read it like 5 times. It never gets old, including when I did the audiobook for it. Very, very good book. Just pizza pie. It's excellent. I also did Reconnaissance Man, which is a book more for the younger set, but this will also help older people, about how you shouldn't just jump into college right out of high school. You should probably get a job and save up some money, get a little nest egg going, and then do some road tripping, figure out what you actually want to do and where you want to do it at, what locale is most advantageous for your business practices. He lays this out very thoroughly in this book, and I highly recommend it. He also has Curse of the High IQ, which is a book that I did not do the audiobook for, but it's still a very good book, in which he hypothesizes that high IQs are correlated with life problems such as alcoholism, depression, crippling anxiety, things like that. And basically the way that he arrived at this was he started noticing that a lot of his very successful friends have all of these crippling life problems. So he got them to all test their IQs, and they all tested very high. So he kind of lays out this hypothesis over the course of this book, and then presents some solutions to dealing with having a high IQ in a normie world. So if you don't think that you're a dummy, if you think that you've got some smarts about you, if you think that you're smarter than the average bear, but you just don't understand why the world is seemingly actively trying to fuck you over, then this is the book for you. It might help you out. It helped me out, helped a couple of my friends out. Might work for you too. Next up is John E. Boyle. John is an author who has written the excellent novel Queen's Heir. That's H-E-I-R, heir to the queen, not the air that the queen breathes. It is a sword and sorcery fantasy novel set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age. And it has everything that you could possibly ask for from a sword and sorcery novel. It is big, and it includes swords, sorcery, curses, werewolves, ghosts, high seas adventure, fantastical races, and all kinds of other sword and sorcery goodness. So go and pick this one up. You will not regret it, fam. I can guarantee you. Next up, we have the affiliate account. So the way the affiliate accounts work is you click on the link, you go to the website, you buy your thing, and then I will get a kickback from the website for sending you over there. So it doesn't cost you anymore, and it doesn't cost the seller anymore. So if you're going to do any shopping on Amazon.com, then, you know, you want to get some of these good books that I've been telling you about lately. You want to go buy some Robert E. Howard stuff, some H.P. Lovecraft stuff. Then go over to my website, jimfear138.blogspot.com. Click on the Amazon link on the left-hand side of the page, and it will take you directly to the website Amazon, where you can buy all of your shit. You'll be helping me out, you'll be helping the seller out, and you'll be getting that cool thing that you want. MyComicShop.com is your one-stop shop for comic books. Just like, I am into some pretty obscure bullshit, fam. Just like, really just niche shit. And it's very rare that I look for something on mycomicshop.com that they don't have it. And usually, if they don't have it in stock, they have a listing for it so that you can wishlist it, and then they will email you when it becomes available. Packages always arrive on time, and they are always very well protected. I have never, ever, in the entire time that I have been buying stuff from this company, received damaged comic books from them. They are always in excellent condition. So go and check out mycomicshop.com if you want to get your Marvel fix used, and you don't want to pay them money. They also have various indie publishers like Alterna. They probably will carry Jawbreakers. WriteStuffAnime.com is basically mycomicshop.com for weeaboos. So if you like some weeb shit, some animu and some mangoes, then you can go over to WriteStuffAnime and look up your thing and buy it. And these guys are directly connected with distributors and localizers and things like that, so they will make sure that your money goes exactly where it needs to go to make sure that people get paid for the effort that they have put in creating this thing. They have manga, they have anime, DVD, Blu-ray, I think they even have some VHS, they have porn, they have hats and jackets and t-shirts, they have Nendoroid figurines, they have the Gundam figurines, they have the titty figurines, just about like any weeb shit that you could imagine, these guys are selling it. So go over there and get your weeb fix. If you want to advertise on the blog, then it is $20 a month, and for that $20, you will get an ad on the blog for the entire month, at least 4 podcasts, because I've been known to, you know, fall off for a week here and there. At least 4 podcasts, you will get an ad on the blog right up at the top where everybody can see it as soon as they come onto the page. You will get a post on the blog detailing your thing and where people can go and buy it. You will get periodic posts on my social media directing people to your thing and telling them that they should go and buy it. You will get a spot in the sponsor role on the podcast right up at the top so that everybody hears that first. And if and you like, I will also do audio and video advertisements for your thing that you can put on your website. I can put them on my BitChute. I can put them on my YouTube. All of that stuff, you know, you can put it into your podcast feed. I can put the audio ad into my podcast feed as well. So yeah, just if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, contact forms on the left-hand side of the blog. Get in touch and we'll hammer out the details. And lastly, we have the Bandcamp. The Bandcamp is where I'm putting my independent narrations of audiobooks. So if you want to go over there and pick up some stuff that's not going to be released through Dimension Bucket Media, you can find some short fiction that I have narrated over there. Some of it is old creepypasta stuff, but I also have The Haunter of the Ring by Robert E. Howard and The Judge's House by Bram Stoker. And there's going to be more coming. It's just whenever I'm able to get around to it, when I'm not swamped with audio commissions and writing and shit like that. When I have time to record stories, I will record them and put them up there. But all right, that's it. That's the podcast. Sorry it was so short and scattershot and, you know, harebrained and all that other bullshit. But this was an emergency recording, as I said. And hopefully next week we will have a better show for you guys. And I apologize. But yeah, I will catch you all next time. Peace out, everybody.